Thanks very much, Ed. I hadn't heard the term actionable news before, but I'll see how we go at generating some. But I assume that's journo speak. So Europe has been at front of mind a lot of late, and the almost daily machinations of the European political system have been a major driver of financial market volatility. And so on that front, I was pleasantly surprised that the Australian summer holiday was pretty much uninterrupted by European headlines. I thought in the beginning of December that wasn't going to be the case. The downside of not being interrupted by European headlines is that we got a pretty crap summer in Sydney. So European developments influence Australian financial markets through a number of channels, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'll focus on a few of those today. So I think the European development that has had the biggest impact on financial markets over the past few months has been the ECB's three-year liquidity operation. So in December, the ECB provided as much three-year funding as the European banking sector wanted at the ECB's policy rate against acceptable collateral. So nearly 500 billion worth of euro was borrowed for 3 years by the European banking system. So that large liquidity injection has had a number of effects. And one of the most important is it effectively takes funding out of the equation for the European banking system in the period ahead. So there's some large maturities. If you have a look on this is European bank bond issuance and maturities. And see, the first quarter of 2012 is the biggest orange bar. So a lot of debt needed to be rolled or refinanced in right now. A lot of that was, a decent chunk of that was government guaranteed debt. So there are serious concerns about the ability of some banks to refinance themselves, but those concerns have basically been taken off the table by the ECB's action. So the ECB has provided banks with the funds to repay those obligations, and indeed ECB commentary suggests that a number of those who borrowed were those with large debt maturities coming up. So in assessing the impact of the ECB's operation, some commentators focus on the size of bank deposits with the ECB as a measure of their effectiveness, and they get quite excited monitoring that on a day-by-day basis. And they say if those deposits are rising, the assessment is that the ECB's actions aren't working because the banks are just parking their money at the ECB and not lending it to the real economy. Now, that's just plain wrong and doesn't sort of indicates a bit of a misunderstanding of the way balance sheets actually work. The size of the bank, so I'd like to try and correct that misperception. The size of the banking system's deposits with the ECB is completely determined by the ECB's liquidity operations. So all you need to do is track what the ECB is doing on the liquidity front, and that tells you everything you need to know. On the ECB's balance sheet, the assets it generates by lending to the banking system when it does these liquidity operations has to appear on the other side of the balance sheet, balance sheet's balance, as a bank deposit with the ECB. So the size, once the ECB's done its liquidity operations, the size of the ECB's balance sheet is what it is. So the amount of deposits provide no information above and beyond the net amount the ECB's injected into the system, which you already know. Doesn't tell you anything about what the banks are actually doing with the funds that they've borrowed from the ECB. When someone borrows and they repay it, they pay off a debt obligation, it ends up in another bank as a deposit, eventually that has to end up back on the ECB's balance sheet. Doesn't tell you how many times those funds circulate before they end up back on the ECB's balance sheet. By the way, this is true of all central banks, not just the ECB. We all have balance sheets which balance. So a similarly misleading statement is often made about the Fed, with bank deposits piling up at the Fed, supposedly indicating that the Fed's policy actions are ineffective. Again, the size of the bank deposits of the Fed is just a straight mirror image of the Fed's liquidity operations. So if that's not a way of working out what's going on, what is a way? One possible way, this is something you probably haven't seen since you're in, if any of you ever did economics, but in your first year economics class, you might have come across a money multiplier and probably have never thought about it again since. Anyhow, it is actually a way to get a handle on what's going on with these liquidity operations and the extent to which the liquidity injected by the central banks actually is being circulated. So this shows money multipliers, which is taking a broader measure of money as a ratio of the money base. It's for the UK, the euro area, and the US. And the money base is broadly the bit which is under control of the central bank. So the graph shows that there's been large declines in the money multipliers in all three of these regions, and the UK has sort of really collapsed. So these declines do provide some indication that the banks aren't circulating or the liquidity isn't being circulated as much as was the case in the recent past. And the declines are consistent with the deleveraging that is occurring in the banking sector and on private sector balance sheets. If you turn it around the other way, it also suggests that the economies in each of these regions are likely to have been significantly weaker if not for the large expansion of central bank balance sheets. So the central banks hadn't... So if you had this collapse in the money multiplier, the central banks hadn't pushed up their balance sheets as much as they had, nominal GDP would have been a hell of a lot lower, and things would have been even worse than they are currently. So while the ECB's liquidity provision significantly reduces the funding risk for European banks, it doesn't do much to address the pressures on bank capital. So a number of European banks are responding to these pressures, somewhat which have been imposed by the European Banking Authority, although it's for their own good as well, by deleveraging rather than by raising equity in the market. Some of that deleveraging is evident in Australia and the Asian region more generally, and particularly around the provision of commodity finance, where the French banks in particular were big players. However, at least in Australia's case, European banks do not have a large presence, and thus far we have seen other banks step in to offset some of this withdrawal. So there's liquidity, funding's basically off taken care of, bank capital is still an issue. Obviously, there are still clearly significant issues in terms of sovereign debt to be resolved. The ECB will conduct another three-year operation at the end of the month, and there is some possibility that that banks will use that operation to fund increased purchases of sovereign debt and earn the large carry-on offer, which might at least help alleviate the sovereign pressure for some time. And whether they do that or not remains to be seen. We've obviously had one bank say it's never going to borrow from the ECB, and estimates range from anywhere between sort of $100 billion and $1 trillion in terms of what might be borrowed. So this graph here, that graph there, shows the collapse in money multipliers that has occurred. It's also interesting to think about the equivalent concept on the other side of the balance sheet, which you might call collateral multipliers. So that is, how many times do assets get recycled in the system, particularly in terms of generating funding? So collateral multipliers aren't something you came across in your first year macro textbook, but they are an important construct in the world of shadow banking, where repo, collateral hypothecation, etc., are crucial. So you think about government security, how many times does that get circulated through the financial system? There are obviously investors who are buy and hold, there are a lot of investors who are buy and use it to generate more funding. Some very interesting work has been done on this in recent times, including by Manmohan Singh and Zoltan Pozdar at the IMF, along with James Aitken. And Hyun Shin and others have developed a useful framework in which to think about the issue, and I think it's an issue which is worth thinking about. The evidence seems to be that there is a sizable reduction in the velocity of collateral taking place at the moment. Some of this is because of a change in the willingness to lend securities because of what's happened over the last few years. The Lehman's collapse itself obviously generated the problem in the sense of collateral getting stuck where people didn't think it was going to get stuck, or finding out that the collateral they thought was theirs didn't actually turn out to be theirs. That's generated the change in the willingness to lend securities on the part of some asset managers. But there's also a number of regulatory changes coming down the pipe. Some are here already and some are coming, which is going to increase the demand for particularly high-quality collateral. So that has this change in terms of collateral use has implications for the provision of credit, as I said, particularly from the shadow banking system. It is an area which hasn't been examined that much to date, but is certainly worth examining in more detail and something we intend to focus on in the period ahead. So returning to the topic of debt issuance, the new year has seen a thawing in bank debt markets. Some of this, I think, can be attributed to the calendar itself. So we got to the end of last year. If you're in front, you didn't want to take any more risk to blow any profit you had. If you were behind, you didn't want to dig yourself into any deeper hole. So everyone just sat back in the last quarter of last year. So with the beginning of the new year, the investment slate is clean. Everyone's basically back to zero, and risk tolerance thus far is on the increase. This development has obviously been bolstered by the avoidance of worst-case outcomes, a number of which were certainly on the table in December, and as I've already mentioned, by the ECB's action. But there's still a reasonably large amount of bank debt maturing in the first quarter. I showed you the European stuff a minute ago. And concerns continue to be expressed about the ability to roll all that debt over. So in thinking about that, I think it's always important to remember that when the debt matures, to think about what's happening on the investor side, the investor who's holding that maturing paper actually has to decide to do with the cash that's coming back into their pocket. So do they reinvest in bank debt, or do they invest it somewhere else, like maybe short-term German paper, which pays you a negative yield. You know, so you have to think about those sort of alternatives. In the current quarter, an additional wrinkle in thinking about this is that a fair chunk of debt maturing is government-guaranteed bank paper. So the decision of some of those investors may not be the same as that of more traditional bank credit investors. So while the market has reopened in the new year, there has been a sizable step up in the cost of issuance. Investors are demanding a much higher compensation for bank credit risk now than they were in mid-2011. So let me show you a bit around this. So this is a table we put, I think we put it in our statement last Friday, and shows you a few debt issues at a few different points in time over the last 6 months. So if you have a look at the top, which is the banks issuing senior unsecured, so in the middle of last year, at about 127 over swap, or that these were some issues actually done. In January this year, was about 200. There was a couple of issues done at about 220 over swap. The NAB deal last week, 185 over swap. So you can see that the unsecured debt issuance costs considerably wider than they were last year, but actually considerably narrower than they were last month. If I move down to the covered bonds, you can see that the covered bonds issued in this year were actually considerably wider than the unsecured issuance last year. So, and that's notwithstanding the fact that covered is obviously senior in the credit queue. With RMBS, you can see an RMBS deal, so less over-collateralisation than a covered bond. The RMBS deal was done in November last year, also much cheaper than the covered bonds done at the beginning of this year. So, obviously, the cost... Now, number of commentators have pointed to the fact that the cost of covered bond issuance in Australia has been quite high. But let me just give you, which is what that second part of the table shows. It was much higher than the unsecured issuance last year. This gives you a few benchmarks, a little hard to read, but all we've done here is take the covered bond issuance, the pricing on covered bonds in a few different jurisdictions. So you can see in the orange dots are the Australian covered bond issues, the white lines, France, the greens, Netherlands, the bluish-purple colour is Norway, and then the purple is Canada. Now, Canada has some government credit enhancement on that, so those guys get to issue cheaper. But you can see that the Australian covered bond issuance are roughly the same as the Scandies, considerably cheaper than the French. So you can also see that where the Australian banks have issued are pretty much in line with their peers, maybe paying a little bit because it's a new issue and the market's not developed yet, but basically in line with their peers. But the other point, which I think is worth noticing here, is if you look down the bottom, it shows you that some corporates are able to issue at lower rates than the banks, even for the AAA rated covered bonds. So if I take, for example, Coke, which is a product I know something about, Coke's rated A-, and they were able to issue last month at 45 over swap for 5 years. A AAA-rated covered bond with the additional credit enhancement that comes with a covered bond, you have to pay 170 over for. You guys are investors. You tell me why that's happening. Maybe you can ask Anne. She bought up some of this stuff, so I'm sure she can explain why the price is where it is. Yes, no, well, I think the covered bonds at that price do look pretty decent. So the rise in wholesale funding costs has been accentuated for funds raised offshore by a widening in the cost of swapping foreign exchange into Aussie dollars. And this is another example of European issues affecting the local market, as the widening is partly a function of the lower volume of kangaroo issuance in recent months. So the kangaroo issuers, I'm sure most of you are aware, seek to swap the dollar A funding they raise back into foreign currency, while the Aussie banks are obviously going the other way, swapping foreign currency into Aussie. So over the past few years, issuance in the first quarter by the kangaroo issuers has generally been pretty strong. That has not been the case so far this year. So ratings uncertainty around European sovereigns has contributed to this. So when a couple of rating agencies downgraded the number of European sovereigns in December, including France, some pan-European entities who relied on the AAA backing of the other European sovereigns, including the EFSF, were downgraded from AAA. The European Investment Bank, which is a very large issuer historically in the Australian market, wasn't downgraded, though it remains on negative watch. So at times there's been pretty poor liquidity in the supermarket and seen spreads widen a lot, particularly EIB, with little turnover behind those wider marks. So the market makers were basically marking those securities wide with basically no transactions going through behind it. But again, reflecting the improved sentiment we've seen over the last couple of months, those spreads have started to narrow and have actually narrowed significantly over the past week. So the final channel I want to talk about in terms of Europe affecting us is about the sizable flows occurring into Australian government debt. So this is just from the balance of payments, and all it does, the orange bars are net foreign purchases of Australian government securities. The blue bars are the private capital flows. So if it's above the line, it's an inflow. If it's below the line, it's an outflow. And then the line is actually the current account deficit as a share of GDP. So if you have a look there, you can see for the last pretty much all of the last 6 or 7 quarters, there's been sizable net inflows into Australian government securities from offshore. In fact, in the first 3 quarters of last year, the net purchases of government securities by foreigners amounted to over 3% of GDP, markedly larger than the current account deficit, which I think, again, shows that the long-held belief that the banks fund the current account was just pretty poor analysis. This clearly hasn't been the case for the last 3 years or 2 or 3 years. That we don't have the data for the December quarter. Almost certainly that pattern has been repeated in December. There was large net repayment by the banking system offshore, and it looks like there was probably fairly sizable foreign purchases of government securities again in the December quarter. So as a result of these purchases, our estimate based on some other ABS data is that around 75% of the stock of CGS is held offshore as at end of September, and my guess is it's probably gone higher since. From our discussions with the market, and we really don't know anything more about this than you guys do, these investors, a lot of the purchases have been by sovereign asset managers. And those investors tend to buy CGS predominantly, although not completely exclusively, rather than debt issued by the state government borrowing authorities. So that's contributed to a widening in spreads between CGS and semis. However, as the one thing which is sometimes lost in that spread widening, which I know you guys tend to focus on, but as the yields on CGS have fallen to 50-year lows, state borrowing costs are not actually all that high by historical standards. They're actually pretty low, even though they're at considerably wider spreads. Now, that portfolio shift by foreign asset managers, and particularly sovereign asset managers, into Australian government securities appears to be having an effect on the currency. Obviously, the Australian dollar is close to its recent highs currently, despite the fact that the terms of trade declined from their peak in the September quarter. So there's some of the channels of influence of the situation in Europe on Australian financial markets. As I said, so far this year, that's been a more positive story than it was at the end of last year, than I expected it would be now. So when I agreed to give this speech, I didn't think we'd be talking in quite such a positive way about Europe. The major instigator of that change, in my opinion, was the ECB's 3-year liquidity operation. Now, whether this happier state of affairs persists is difficult to tell. There have obviously been outbreaks of optimism over the past couple of years, which were dashed. Sometimes they were dashed, like in November, within the space of 24 hours. So we've actually had a pretty decent run for the last 6 to 8 weeks of positive news out of Europe. So I think the only thing that is certain is that uncertainty is likely to persist for some time to come. So in that vein, now I need a bit of visual assistance here. This is another part of your musical education for you all. So I'll get to this in a second. But I'd like to finish with a variation on the famous Rumsfeldian take on uncertainty, which was recently put out by David Murphy on his Deus Ex Machiato blog. So there are known unknowns and there are unknown unknowns, as obviously Rumsfeld said, which complicate the pricing of risk. But over the past decade, there's also been a fair few examples of too lazy to be knowns. So European sovereign debt seems to me to fall right into that category. Up until 2007, there was basically no spread between German bunds and any of the peripheral sovereign borrowing costs. Basically, investors couldn't be bothered to do the due diligence. Suddenly, everyone's an expert on the European fiscal situation. Apparently, they weren't an expert on the European fiscal situation in 2007, but everyone is now. So basically, beware of the too lazy to be knowns. So while mispricing due to 19 uncertainty is excusable, mispricing due to laziness is not. So to get to this, so in a speech I gave last November, I quoted the Saints, when it comes to investing, you've got to know your product. Now, Know Your Product is the first song on side one. I'm going showing my age here because I don't think I still have vinyl, but which apparently is coming back into fashion. But anyhow, Know Your Product is the first song on side one. So those of you who are fans of the Saints know the last song on side one is Know Your Product, which I think is a good way of describing the situation in Greece at the moment. It's another way of putting the quote from Getty from a long time ago. If you owe the bank $100, that's your problem. If you owe the bank $100 million, that's the bank's problem, which I think is a fairly accurate summation of the Greek situation at the moment. And as I said, is fairly well encapsulated by side one of Eternally Yours. So let me finish there. Thanks.
Dr. DeBell, you mentioned in your speech the effect of funding costs on banks. Given the fact in the last week we've seen the majors raise rates, albeit smallly, does that change the way the RBA assesses the economy?
No, I don't think it changes the way we assess the economy. We assess it in the same way. I mean, the governor said on a number of occasions, we take into account the overall financial conditions in the economy, including the level of mortgage rates and determining where we set the cash rate. Steve mentioned earlier that the spread between the cash rate and mortgage rates has changed a lot over the past 20 years. It was actually 425 basis points as high as it got to going back to 1994. Came down a long way. It's gone back up, by about 125-ish points now. So both that decline and the subsequent rise in that spread is one of the factors that is taken into account by the board in setting monetary policy.
Morning, Rory Robertson, Westpac Treasury guy. So my question is, the banks have responded to the higher European intensification of European problems and higher funding costs by edging up their mortgage rates by 9 basis points. How does the bank think about that in terms of financial conditions? On the one hand, the cost of mortgages has gone up a bit, but on the other hand, the availability of mortgages is probably a bit greater than it would otherwise have been. There's sort of less prospect of any credit rationing. How does the bank think about those issues?
I don't quite understand this credit rationing argument, which has been talked about. I know it's Mike Hurst mentioned it this morning. I mean, one's price, the other is quantity. So it's not, the banks have actually been able to raise these funds, which is addressing the quantity issue. The question is what price that they've been able to raise at, and as I showed you, that price has gone up. So, by and large, the banks are able to obtain, they are able to obtain as much funding as they need to fund the growth in their balance sheets at the moment, and that's been true for the last few years, and I don't see any reason why that's not going to be true in the period ahead. The issue is the price, and the price in terms of the way that then flows through to lending rates in the economy, and there are lending rates besides mortgage rates out there in the economy, so the way it flows through to lending rates, both mortgages and to business lending rates, is something that we can take into account in assessing the overall stance of financial conditions.
Thanks, Guy, for another great speech there. My question's also about monetary conditions, and you did mention at the end there, and gave some really good illustrations why the Australian dollar might be affected by the inflow of money into the Australian government sovereign bonds. And it made me think about the statements that the Reserve Bank made in the last couple of weeks, or the last week, about the rise in the Australian dollar not accompanied by an increase in the terms of trade. So I guess my question is, the flow of money into the bond market might be an explanation for the higher currency, but it certainly doesn't mean that the rise in the currency above the terms of trade is not some sort of tightening in monetary conditions, I would have thought. So I'm just interested in that interplay between the capital inflow and actual financial conditions in our economy, with the currency travelling above the sorts of levels that the terms of trade would suggest it should be.
Yeah, no, you're right. I don't think we ever said it wasn't any tightening. It is a tightening in conditions, which was taken into account in the board's deliberations.
Hi, Guy. John Keogh from the Financial Review. There's been some market commentary recently from economists and also some US bond investors we've been speaking to, suggesting the RBA is very hard to read in terms of where it's going to move rates. Just interested in your thoughts to know, should the market and should bond investors have that inclination about interest rate expectations from the RBA, or should they just be guessing and have no idea where they are moving?
I think we can still give a reason. I mean, trying to pick things meeting by meeting, I suppose the Fed's not very hard to read on where they're going with rates, because they're told you're going to keep rates at zero for the next three years. Now, we could obviously decide to put ourselves in that situation and have 9-10% unemployment. So I can't say whether we're difficult or not to read. You know, ask these guys. And, you know, the fact that 24 of 27 economists don't get things right, particularly when you give them 2 months to think about things, that's always dangerous rather than 4 weeks. But anyhow, what matters is the general direction on rates. And what we're doing is setting rates which are appropriate for the economy as a whole, not appropriate for bond market position holding.
I'd like to step away from monetary policy for a minute. One of the puzzles in empirical macroeconomics is the coincidence of global business cycles. I was wondering if you could give an opinion on why it is that global business cycles seem to be so tightly correlated, much more tightly than can be explained by trade flows.
I actually think, barring that, over the last few years, there's actually been a bit of a breakdown in that. So what you said it was sort of true. We had a reasonable correlation with the US for a number of years, which I think was mostly a function of moving through the same process of financial deregulation and whatever at the same time, and experiencing roughly the same sort of credit cycles. If you look at, we weren't all that synchronised with Europe, for instance. The European recession in the early 90s was 2 years later than it was in the US and here. But then if you look what's happened over the last, since 2007, with the exception of the fourth quarter 2008, which was clearly a very large global shock, there's actually been a reasonable amount of delinking of business cycles. I mean, you look what happened in the fourth quarter of this year, right? The US experienced somewhere around trend growth. Europe was in recession. UK was in recession. We were somewhere around trend. And China somewhere around trend. So I think there have been some shocks which have generated that correlation. I still think what you said is true, though, is that cycles are more correlated than you would think from just the straight macro or the straight trade linkages. I think nowadays, I think it's clear that on top of the trade linkages, there's also a very important financial linkage, which was made most evident in the last quarter of 2008.
Roger Montgomery down the back.
G'day, Guy. Roger Montgomery. A quick question for you. Actually, I have two. The first one is, are you at all concerned as the Reserve Bank that with the banks decoupling their interest rate settings from what you're doing at the RBA, that monetary policy becomes a blunter instrument in your inflation targeting?
No, I don't think it changes that. That changes the effect of monetary policy on the economy much at all. As I said, we're, you know, after achieving the right interest rate setting in for the economy as I said, it's not necessary whether it's exactly right, you know, week by week is not so important as whether it's right in, you know, sort of month by month, and I don't think that that has changed materially at all. I mean, we still have, you know, when we move interest rates, it's still going to have some impact on lending rates. I mean, one thing which is interesting in this whole discussion is that there's a focus on the shift on the relationship between the cash rate and lending rates. If you think about the transmission mechanism as a whole, which goes through lending rates, as Rob was talking about, the exchange rate and a whole number of other factors, there are always a whole lot of imprecisions along the way. I mean, it's not a precise task.
It just strikes
at the moment, there happens to be focus on one particular part of the transmission mechanism, which isn't as tight as it was in the past. And if you think about, if you think about the Fed, right, most US mortgages are 30-year fixed. So the Fed is operating an instrument at the front end of the curve to affect a 30-year borrowing rate. We at least have the luxury of operating at the front end of the curve to affect a mortgage rate which is broadly driven, or lending rates more generally, which are broadly driven off the front end of the curve. The fact that relationship is not exactly one for one makes our life a little harder than it otherwise would be, but it's a hell of a lot easier than in a lot of other countries.
Thank you. And the decision not to cut rates last week was followed almost exactly 24 hours by a surprise inflation number out of China. That possible exporting of inflation now by China. Is that any? Was that at all in your deliberations? Is that something that came?
I won't talk about exactly what the board's deliberations are because the minutes come out next week, and you can think what they're talking about. See what they were talking about there. The only thing I would say on that Chinese inflation number is they had two Chinese New Years within the one year-ended inflation number. So when Chinese New Year comes along, food prices go up. This time around, just because of the workings of the calendar, there happen to be two of them in that one observation. So I wouldn't be calling a mass rise in inflation another pickup in inflation in China quite yet.
Guy, I've got a quick question about bond market liquidity. One of the lessons of the GFC was the importance of liquidity in markets. With the budget moving to surplus and the prospect of, whoever wins the next election, having the commitment to budget surpluses and the rest of it, is there any concern over the medium term that these surpluses will filter into a lowering of CGS issuance and an impact on liquidity in the bond market, like we saw 5 years ago when the CGS market fell to, I think, about $50
billion? Yeah. There was actually something, which I'm sure you're aware, that in the last year's budget, which talked about this, and Treasury got together a group, which I think involves some people sitting along here, from memory, which looked at the issue of bond market liquidity, and we were involved in that too. And the general assessment was that maintaining CGS on issue at somewhere around 10 to 12% of GDP was a good, was about what was necessary to maintain a liquid bond market given the various demands on the bond market going forward. So that's certainly, from my perspective, from our perspective, the bank's perspective, in terms of maintaining a liquid bond market, we think it would be desirable to maintain the stock on issue at somewhere, some number around that in the medium term. It's around about where it is at the moment, actually.